From the Sky News Centre at 5, a Royal Navy serviceman's been arrested over a shooting on board a nuclear-powered submarine, which left one of his colleagues dead and a second with life-threatening injuries. Local civic dignitaries were visiting HMS Astute, which is currently docked in Southampton, at the time of the incident. The Ministry of Defence says the shooting is not terrorist-related. Our defence correspondent Neil Patterson is at the MOD.
Quite clearly, an incident that no one in the Royal Navy would have expected to have taken place, although given the fact that small arms are carried on board submarines routinely for guard duties and for other purposes, it is always a possibility that an incident like this should take place.
News International is admitting liability over the News of the World phone hacking allegations and has apologised unreservedly. The company says past behaviour at the News of the World towards several public figures was a matter of genuine regret. MP Keith Vaz is the chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee, which launched an inquiry into the scandal. He's welcoming the decision.
Those who are going to court should be able to, in effect, bring their cases to a conclusion if they feel that that's what they want to do, by way of getting compensation. And I think that this is the right step for the victims.
The Foreign Secretary William Hague's denied the government's defence review will be reopened. There's been speculation some areas scheduled for cuts may get a reprieve due to the recent action in Libya. A government attempt to deport a failed asylum seeker who killed a 12-year-old girl in a hit-and-run has been rejected. The Court of Appeals ruled Asso Mohammed Ibrahim can stay in the country. Tanning salons in England and Wales, which let under-18s on their machines, could be hit with a £20,000 fine. It's part of legislation designed to protect the young, considered to be more vulnerable to skin damage. And the AA says drivers face petrol prices, which are on average 14 pence a litre more expensive than a year ago. Latest fuel prices show petrol is averaging £1.34 a litre. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gove.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Marina Morris, standing in for Tony Goslin. Tony is away this week at the delegate meeting of the National Union of Journalists. The main topics to be covered in this week's news are Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg wants to introduce measures for the social mobility, but no targets or quotas. We ask why. The UK's industrial output, especially oil and gas production, is falling. Is this a sign that we are heading into a double dip recession? The Prime Minister David Cameron announced this week another humiliating climb down, putting the brakes on the government's health reform. Pension reform, this many people being asked to work longer. It's the 50th anniversary of the Yuri Gagarin first space flight, and now companies are proposing space travel for the super rich. And many other interesting stories in the busy week of news. I'm joined this week by Lib Dem Councillor for Eastville, Steve Comba, and our regular guest, Oxford economist Martin Summers, in the studio. After 6 o'clock news, Britain's Secret Service. There have been 5 notable UK whistleblowers in the last 15 years. Who are they? And what do they tell us of the dirty tricks being done in our name throughout the world? That is in the second hour after 6. Our review of this week's news is coming up soon. But the first weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. Will be clear and warm, with a minimum temperature of 7 degrees centigrade. This weekend will be sunny and warm, with heights of 19 degrees on Saturday and 18 degrees on Sunday. Next week will be sunny and dry, but getting colder, with heights of 17 degrees on Monday and down to 10 degrees by Friday. Windy from Thursday. Next weekend, wet, this height of 9 degrees on Saturday and 8 degrees on Sunday. That was Bristol 2 Weekends weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce our this week guests. Now, in the studio, Lib Democrat Councillor for Eastville, Steve Combe. Hello, Steve, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you, Marina.
What got you into politics?
Oh, I've had an interest for a long time, and probably it was about the age of 11, 12. But the actual trigger is an interesting one. Around about that time, we had radio stations operating off the coast of the UK and broadcasting signals in, and the government at the time wanted to take steps that would make that operation difficult through legislation. And it was at that time when I looked at the arguments that they were putting forward, which were that there were a shortage of frequencies, there were threats to emergency services and so on, and gradually, you know, because I'm quite bright, researched these and realised that actually government was engaged in an attempt of trying to mislead people. So rather than being, you know, the protector of citizens, as it said, it was actually trying to mislead people and, you know, trying to get control. And what their biggest problem was, they wanted control of the media for themselves. And I think some of the changes that we've seen since, the AB radio is a good example. Iran is very keen on it because it's very difficult to broadcast cross-border. And I suppose it was this that got me looking and thinking about, you know, what is the role of government and representative democracy. So that was the main trigger. And then, you know, there were a lot of major events happening around about that time. We had the Vietnam War, we had the invasion of Czechoslovakia, and so there were some big world events at the time. But you know, then beyond that, I mean, that developed the interest in terms of the participation. I suppose I got to a stage in my 20s when I was living in Bristol and looking at things that needed doing and thinking that, you know, nobody seems to be really taking any interest in the neighbourhood I was in, and so you end up looking around to see who will, and when there's nobody behind you, you think, well, I better have a go myself.
Why did you choose to join to the Liberal Democratic Party?
I think it was largely because of the initial, the initial trigger. There was a Labour government that was in power at the time of that Marine Offences Act that I mentioned. So that put me off them. I always felt the Conservatives were a party of pure privilege, and I liked a lot of what the Liberal Party, as it then was saying. And certainly I looked at some of the background people, personalities in the Liberal Party, particularly David Lloyd George, and people like Maynard Keynes, Beveridge and so on, who'd laid the foundation of the welfare state, which had been very much done by the Liberal government prior to the First World War, and thought that actually that was a better model than others. I never saw a big, powerful, centralised state as being something I was particularly comfortable with, and so I think that naturally led me into liberal democracy, and so I was with the Liberal Party. I had a period of time when I wasn't in the political party at all, but I then came back again.
What committees do you serve on?
I chair the Human Resource Committee, which is the Personnel Committee of the Council, and a thing with a grand title of Overview and Scrutiny, which is actually, you know, looking at policies of the Council and coordinating the work of scrutiny. We have this split between a cabinet and a scrutiny system on local authorities. I don't agree with it. It was brought in by Tony Blair. But we have that split now. I also chair corporate health and safety. I do a lot of work as a councillor in this human resource field. I'm currently on the national executive of my trade union, so I've got a trade union background as well, and so that tends to lead me in that sort of direction.
Some of your committee are understandably private. Can you discuss your remit or the type of issues that you manage?
Very little is actually private. I also sit on one of the planning committees. That is all in the public domain. Overview and scrutiny is all in the public domain. In fact, the only time that we have a private session on committee is when you're discussing something to do with an individual. So, for instance, on Human Resource Committee, if we're talking about a redundancy of an officer, then if you can identify the individual officer, then that has to be in closed session. But everything else is all in the public domain.
With the cuts in central government funding and the freeze on council tax, resulting in the need to save £28 million, it's 7% of the budget. Some of your staff must be worried for their job. Are you still planning about 160 compulsory redundancies and to lose 340 jobs this year?
It's 160 redundancies. We're hoping we can get the majority of those by voluntary means, and that's always the hope. I've been very clear as chair of HR, Human Resources, that we need to move gradually to a position with reducing staff. And in fact, we've made great progress over the last year in terms of we've taken out a lot of fixed-term contract posts. We've reduced reliance on consultants, and we've removed a lot of agency staff posts from the council. And as we downsize, instead of employing agency staff from outside, the people who are displaced will be in a redeployment pool, and they can be used to fill gaps, to sample jobs and so on. So it's our aim to avoid compulsory redundancies. And so far, if you look at Bristol's record and compare it with, say, Manchester, where they announced 2,000 redundancies, you know, and it's not that different in terms of size of council, then I think we've managed that fairly well. But we started the process over a year ago.
How will this affect the public?
Well, we're doing what we can to maintain frontline services. So, unlike Gloucestershire and Somerset nearby, we're not cutting libraries, we're not cutting essential services. We're hoping to improve the efficiency of how we deal with operations by looking at processes and streamlining those. We've had a big growth in terms of the customer service centres, the telephone work. We're trying to get public inquiries to be done in a more effective way. So if we can move, there will always be a percentage of people who need to come in and talk to someone in an office, but not everybody does. And those that are happy to use the telephone, we'll gear them there. Those that are happy to use email, then we'll try and move them in that direction. So we're trying what we can to be more efficient, to pare down costs, and looking at things like external procurement equally. So we're doing all we can, but I mean, you're right, it is tough times, and it's not easy.
But with all of this focus on cuts, are we in danger of losing sight of the effects on the most vulnerable people in society?
Well, we mustn't do that. I think it's important that we don't do that, and that we do what we can to protect the most vulnerable. And I think we also have one of the issues that came up in the budget, which was a small budget line but an important one. Was initially there was talk of reducing the support to debt advice. Now we didn't. We've actually increased that slightly because we realised that with people under pressure, then there is a need for that sort of service. And so I think we're trying to do that as much as possible. But you know, there are a lot of changes happening, and there are always difficulties. But there are things we can do with new ways of working as well, so that we don't. For instance, if somebody comes into an office, picks up their work and goes out and visits people, well, why don't we just give them a handheld BlackBerry or something and say, well, go straight to your first person. And if the plans change during the day, then we'll get in touch with you and change it. So we can work more effectively. And I think that's what we're trying to do. Whether that'll be enough over the 3 years, we shall see. But certainly, I think we've made a good start.
Our regular guest, Oxford economist Martin Summers, is in the studio. Martin, according to the Office for National Statistics, UK unemployment is 2.53 million, the highest number since 1994 and rising. What do you think? What lesson can we learn from past recession?
Well, this is potentially worse than past recessions because of the nature of the crisis that's created it. It's a crisis in the private financial system. Past recessions have often been political recessions where the government has decided to squeeze out inflation by raising interest rates. It's always been a political choice. This one has been forced on the politicians by the failure of the private markets, and we haven't seen anything like this since the 1930s. So there's a real danger that it's not a recession, it's a depression. I mean, the word recession was invented in the 1950s so that we didn't have to use the old-fashioned word depression, because that's what they used to be called.
Is this just affecting the poorest and weakest in society who depend on council services and a few better of council employee?
Well, it's obviously the in any society, it's the people at the weakest that are going to suffer the most. And what's very interesting about this recession, depression, whatever we want to call it, is the financial sector, which has been bailed out, is now booming. And of course, the hope is that the financial sector, through booming, will then create make the rest of the economy pick up. I think that's fantastical hope, because what's actually happened is that the financial sector has become disengaged from the real economy where people live and work. And it's actually the success of the financial sector is actually at the expense of the real economy. And this will become increasingly obvious as we go forward, I think.
What does this mean for the local economy?
Well, local economies like Bristol are caught in a vice. I mean, whoever was running the city council would be faced with the same choices, because central government sets the parameters under which local government can make decisions. I think at some point people are going to question the economic strategy that's being pursued. And no doubt we'll, you know, Steve will have his own views on this. I think we've had a generation of believing in the magic of the market. And I think it behoves all political parties and serious people to recognise that that free market utopia is over, and that we need to get a better balance between free markets and interventions which prevent market failure, basically.
Now, let's take a look at this week's news. Social mobility. Steve, what do you think of your party leader's new proposal?
I know Nick Clegg is very committed to social mobility, and I think it's been a bit of a holy grail of successive governments, because, you know, John Major talked about it, and Tony Blair also talked about it, so now Nick Clegg's talking about it. I think we need to seriously look at barriers and attitudes, because I think a lot of it comes from that, and we really do need to move to a society where people get places on merit. And it's interesting, I was talking to a primary head teacher this afternoon, and we were talking about a school where, one of the secondary schools in Bristol where I used to be governor, and it's been rebuilt. It had the best increase, this is Bristol Metropolitan Academy, had the best increase in GCSE results in the country last year, and yet admission numbers for next September are still fairly poor, because it's perceived by parents as a low achieving school. Well, it's now not a low achieving school, and if you've got that perception at that level, when you're still talking people of school age, then obviously it's going to carry on through society. As I say, I know this is something that very much exercises Nick Clegg, and it did through his leadership campaign. Where it's difficult is to say, well, what do you do practically in order to bring change about? Because once you start going down the road of quotas and so on, then we saw that in America, you get a danger of a backlash. So I think it is a question of trying to change attitudes and behaviours, and that's quite a long-term prospect. But if the commitment is there, then I think it's strong. Interestingly, finance that Martin mentioned did this very rapidly. They had what they called the Big Bang in the 80s, which got rid of a lot of the old boy sort of network, and you had a lot of people coming into the city from different backgrounds. And okay, short-term boom, there's been a lot of problem with financial services, but it shows that in a social level we can do it, and I think we need to.
Martin, how realistic are these proposals?
I mean, obviously, we want a fair society where everybody gets a fair chance, wherever they come from, to get whatever posts of opportunity there may be. But I think we also have to question about fairness in general in society. Somebody will always have to work in shops. Some people will always have to work in factories. And we actually need to have a more equal society anyway, equal in outcomes, not just in chances. We don't want a dog-eat-dog society. I mean, China, for example, today is a dog-eat-dog society, yeah, for the poor and the rich. And, of course, it's equal opportunity. The poorest people can get to the top, but the bottom is still the bottom. And and what we need is actually, The spirit level, a book which I recommended to you, Marina. There is a discussion about how more equal societies are happier, healthier societies, and it was written by Kate P. Pickett and Richard Wilkinson, I believe, and it's been great, very influential. Yeah. And of course, we want equality of opportunity, but I don't think Steve would disagree that we actually need a more equal society in general. With somebody's got to be a hewer of wood and a drawer of water, but they should have proper healthcare, a trade union to protect them, and a decent wage.
Yeah, I think that's right. I would agree with that, and I think that. And it's not just UK. I mean, I think we've got to look at examples across. I think increasingly now we need to be thinking in terms of the European continent and specifically as a whole, and specifically the 27 nations of the European Union. And I think we need to be looking at that sort of mobility as well. And you know, but it's not just geographical. It's social and. You know, we really do need to home in on it. As I say, I read a lot of good things in what Nick Clegg is saying about the commitment to improve social mobility. I think it's a question of, and it does go from foundation years through to the world of work. But there is a factor as well. I mean, I've made comment about big government. Government can't do this on its own either. You know, we have to make sure we've got a better attitude from employers and so on that will look at people across the ability range and you know, consumers and so on as well. And I think if we can get that change, it will work. But I'm also aware that I think some European countries, particularly the Benelux, Scandinavia, and Germany, already do this better than we do. So, you know, let's have a look at what works over there and see what of what they do we can apply here. And some of it we can, some of it probably not. But, you know, I think there are better examples, and both in terms of balance of the economy, as we've mentioned earlier, and in terms of social mobility. So let's home in on good practice.
Save the Children says that 1.6 million of the UK's 13 million children are affected by severe poverty, more than 12%. Is greater social mobility a realistic escape route for the masses?
Well, I think it will be. And as Martin said, you know, not everyone's going to be able to escape. I think social mobility is a major help from that. But equally, if you're talking about tackling child poverty, then you do need to make sure that you've got the basic building blocks of your welfare state in place to make sure that you give people those opportunities. And you know, some will be able to take them up and others may not, but I think it is a question of getting that basic minimum level there. And as Martin said, in places like China and so on, then that safety net isn't there.
Can I just say that your economic policy often determines the kind of social outcomes that you get. So it all comes back to the economic choices that you make. And we, you know, the more free market societies with more inequality have less social mobility. And you know, you've got to recognise that economic policy is the key to most of these things.
I mean, it's interesting if you look at, in the UK, a lot of people tend to look towards the United States as a model, and that is a more unequal, more vicious society in one way. You don't have the aristocracy and the sort of the traditional hierarchies of society, but the gap between haves and have-nots. I mean, I've only been to America a couple of times, but it's quite notable, and the attitude is very different. I think one of the things that's interesting here, ever since the National Health Service has been built up, people might not like the details, or you know, they wait too long for an operation, or they might not get on with a particular GP or whatever. But there seems to be a pretty universal commitment to it. Whereas in America, there is a real opposition to this concept that wealthier people should actually pay a bit of their income to help the general health of the nation, and that helping the general health of the nation helps society as a whole. And if you speak to wealthy Americans, they just don't have that concept at all. It's completely alien. Whereas in the UK, as in most of Europe, then that's very fundamental to us.
I recently asked the people of Bristol about social mobility. Let's hear what you had to say. Statistics show that children from richer families are more successful, live longer, and have healthier and better lives. Are the children of the poor less intelligent than the children of the rich?
I don't think necessarily that poorer children are less intelligent. It's just that, see, children with richer backgrounds, they can get access to supposed better teaching. But I think if a poor person really wants to further themselves, they have the ability to do so. Well, family is always very, very important. They give their younger generation all the guiding they need because they have all the experience. If anyone doesn't listen to their family, then they're pretty stupid.
Yeah, I believe the children of the poor are less intelligent of the children of the rich, and that comes from children of the poor going to worse schools, having worse parents, and basically the whole environment is much worse than, say, if you live in a with a rich family. But eventually, when they're growing up in the environment they grow up, obviously they're disadvantaged.
No, because people who want to learn will learn.
It depends where you live, in the community where you are, and if your family had a good education before.
Are they less intelligent? No, because they wouldn't have had the necessary opportunities as rich people, rich parents would be able to give their children. So I think that does generally stem down to money, because obviously being rich can offer a shortcut to better facilities, but it needn't be a barrier.
Would greater social mobility improve society, and who or what needs to change?
Particularly teaching, probably the standards in teaching probably has fallen quite in recent years, and hopefully the new government will help to put that right. Also parents as well, it seems that a few parents these days, they seem to become a little bit lazy, so I think everyone needs to pull their socks up.
In this country it's been like this for like hundreds of years, separation of the classes. You have the poor, working class, middle class, upper middle class and the rich, and I think that will stay, if not forever, for a long, long time. So I don't think anything can change this. The separation of the classes will be there for ages and ages.
Education, overall, for everybody, not just for the children trying to learn, for the adults who perhaps didn't have a good education, just to help them.
In a perfect world, and there wouldn't be any class system, there wouldn't be prejudice against children or anyone depending on their bank accounts, etc. So the only thing that's ever going to change any of this is getting rid of those kind of class barriers, but it's never going to happen in this land and in this world.
That was the opinion of Bristolians about social mobility. Steve, there didn't seem to be much expectation of an improvement. Any comments?
Well, I think there can be an improvement. I think there has been an improvement. I think social mobility now is better than it was when I was a child. So I think there has been improvement. The question is the rate of improvement strong enough, and is there a danger with the economic position we're in that we might go backwards in terms of mobility? And I think I think that's the worry I have. But in general, I'm optimistic, and I think we can get change. I think we certainly, companies and businesses want to employ the best and the brightest rather than the poshest. And if we can encourage that. One of the people there talked about educational opportunities, and I think one of the things that's exercised me quite a lot is there's always a lot of emphasis on universities and A-levels and so on. And where I think we fall down, certainly compared with countries like Germany and more central European countries, is in the vocational level and in the non-degree further education. I mean, a lot of my family traditionally were educated through night school, post school. They went to an employer, they needed a qualification to get to the next level, and they would do it that way. And I do worry about what's happening to the colleges and a lot of these routes, because I think we need very much education not to be seen as something that happens between 5 and 16 or beyond, but something that's lifelong. And we've seen now, I mean, I've got people who are over 70 in my ward who love the opportunity to go and do a computer course and learn how to use a PC, and that's what we need to be looking at.
Well, I mean, obviously I generally agree with that, although, as I say, we've got to think about, although social mobility may have improved in the last generation, social inequality has increased under both Labour and Conservative governments. So, you know, it's a winner-take-all system. The losers go to the wall. Interestingly enough, I know for a fact that mainstream universities, when they're interviewing A-level candidates with their A-level grades predicted, they always mark down the privately educated by half a grade and mark up the publicly educated by half a grade. And that's not based on prejudice. It's because they know when it comes to finals, when they have to work independently without all the support and help that they've had at school, they will not do as well as state school
pupils.
They can't be hothouse through it. They can't be spoon-fed. And that's the universities have done that on a perfectly rational basis. It's not it's not a prejudice.
No.
So that makes it harder for private school children to get into university on the same grades.
And I know some of the universities that look favourably on more mature students coming in, and maybe they won't demand two A's and a B or whatever if someone's got life experience. And I think that's the sort of thing that needs to happen. But as I say, it's the raft of national vocational qualifications and BTECs and all these sort of things that I think are where we're falling down as an economy to a large extent. And I think we need to reskill our workforce in that way. And if that needs the I'm quite sanguine about it. If that needs the return of some sort of levy system, which is what we had to do in the past because private companies wouldn't do it on their own, then let's go for that. I mean, we've reduced corporation tax, so it's not as if companies are bearing a heavy burden. They've had lower corporation tax than ever. But, we do need companies and businesses to cooperate as well, and maybe a return of a levy system might be something we ought to look at.
Can I just mention the other possibility of social mobility is downward social mobility. We may be moving into this depression, worldwide depression, having a situation where middle-class people will not, in fact, get middle-class jobs because they're not available. And it's actually going to be a big shock. And, of course, these people are much more likely to rebel than the poor and the marginalised.
Let's move to the next question. UK's industrial production was down by 1.2% in February. This is the biggest fall in the oil and gas sector. Martin, given the new tax on oil companies announced in the budget, is this the shape of things to come?
Well, I've only just heard about this, Marina, so it's hard for me to comment other than to say that I'm not surprised by a fall in industrial output. It's what I would expect to see as a result of the environment that we're in. Not just the policy of the government and cuts and so on, it's the international environment. Everybody is cutting simultaneously. And, of course, that means your export markets are shrinking. I think, eventually, this idea that we can cut our way out of recession is going to be exploded as a myth. Steve mentioned earlier Maynard Keynes. He was a very key British economist of the 20th century, and he would basically be saying at this stage, what you're doing is economically illiterate, and eventually that will come through. It's not come through in the Labour front bench at this stage, by the way.
No. I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's where it's happened. I mean, I've only just picked this up as well. But actually, the strongest performer amongst all the industry sectors has been manufacturing. And so the fall in industrial output, it's been heavily affected by a fall in mining and quarrying and primary activity. Manufacturing sector, they've benefited from decent orders. The fall in the pound's probably helped.
There's probably a lot to do with it.
And, I think there is a... Martin's probably more of an expert in this than me, but, I mean, I think there is a unspoken policy to keep the value of the pound low going on, actually.
But you can then get a situation of competitive devaluation because, of course, you're forcing out other people are losing because your pound is coming down in value and they won't like that, and they'll then try and force the euro down. They're not actually trying to force the euro down. You see what the European Central Bank have done.
Yeah.
They've raised interest rates this week. I think that's absolutely insane. But there you go. They've got a very monetarist mindset.
Mm. NHS reform. Steve, your party conference rejected the health and social care bill. It seems as if minor change to proposals are being made to arrive at a new bill, not rejected but your conference. What do you think of the proposed change to the NHS?
I'm not a fan of old big government status solutions, so I think that there did need to be change in the NHS. But equally, there's worry about accountability and transparency. I think that the conference vote was really very helpful in terms of getting that right and getting that balance right, and having greater. We're dealing with a lot of public money here, and I think we do need greater scrutiny. We do need to make sure that the private sector don't cherry pick the high value but low complexity operations, and I welcome that there's a look at this and a look at the structure, and I think we do need to make major changes, and you know, I'm really very happy about what's happening. I think there's also been some nervousness amongst Conservative ranks as well in this one, and as I said earlier on, I mean, the concept of the National Health Service is very dear to a lot of people. I mean, it's dear to me. I've been asthmatic since birth and have benefited from that carefree at the point of delivery, and I think that is, it is important that is maintained. Having said that, I don't think you need massive tiers of bureaucracy. I mean, I've had a really difficult job in recent weeks trying to get an answer on what is happening about the proposed redevelopment of Eastfield Health Centre. I've now had a reply from the Primary Care Trust after about three prompts and so on. So you've got a very unaccountable bureaucracy there, and that needed to change. But we've got to be careful with this, that we don't end up with major surgery that destroys the patient, as it were.
Martin, is the NHS safe in Mr. Cameron's hands?
I would have to say no. I think that this case has not been properly made for a generation. Having an overall plan and a central bureaucracy is not necessarily wrong, and this is probably the division between Steve's politics and mine. I actually think that having a plan is actually quite sensible, and of course the Conservatives are starting to get cold feet, because Conservatives are conservative, and one of the great Conservative mottos is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And in actual fact, I didn't agree with many of the new Labour reforms of the health service, frankly. I mean, I'm not a very great fan of PCTs either, but the fact is that the satisfaction with the health service as it was very, very high, and I think politically this pause is because out there in the shires people are saying we're not very happy with the direction of this, and I think this is quite fundamental, and it's going to be a make or break test for this coalition government, I think.
PCT abolition. There are worries about amongst doctors that change in NHS funding models could make things worse. A recent report from the Care Cancer Foundation states that GPs are falling to recognize one in four cancer cases. If we focus attention on NHS reform and managing budgets, are we taking even more resources away from the patients?
Well, they shouldn't do, because although the GPs will be organising this, I don't think you're going to take GPs away from their core work. What it will probably mean is that it'll be the practice managers, in effect, that are doing the day-to-day administration of this. So I don't see that as a problem. If there's a difficulty with things not being diagnosed, then that's a matter of professional standards that needs to be taken up through that level, but it's not always easy with diagnosis. I think we've all had experiences of that not being done first time, because sometimes you know, there's a lot of unknowns, so it's not an exact area of my work.
Martin?
Well, I mean, obviously I welcome the vote at the Liberal conference. I think this is too important for it to be taken as in a trivial way. But I think we also people have to understand that competition is not the answer to everything. If you've got a hammer in your hand, every problem looks like a nail. And in actual fact, competition is not... I mean, what really worries many doctors is that when they see a patient in front of them, the patient is going to say, am I going to get the best treatment, or is he thinking how I can get the cheapest treatment? Because I've not got a doctor in front of me, I've got a business person. And that is something that the BMA have said. We don't want our patients to be even thinking that in the back of their minds, that some decision is being taken, because we're actually business people now who are also doctors. And I've had a very bad experience of this myself, Marina. My Polish girlfriend died of cancer in Poland, and of course we had to pay for everything, cash up front. And of course you've got a very big question about what you're paying for and what's going on. And the thing about the NHS system as we have known it is it gives peace of mind to everybody concerned. And that could easily be lost. That trust is essential, and if it's gone, it's gone.
This is why I think, you know, the scrutiny role is so important, and that we do have And a role... See, one of the difficulties is, with any administrative chain, it is this question of accountability. And I think one of the things that the Liberal Democrat conference motion recognises, if you have accountability through elected councillors, then at least there is a direct line of accountability to the public. And this is one of the problems that in a lot of... I think we suffer in the UK and have for several decades from a sort of concept of managerialism that is scared about involving the public and in involving the public through elected representatives. Yet we are a democracy, and I think that's what we should be encouraging. And I hope that we can see a move away from this rather knee-jerk managerialist approach to say, actually, on a lot of these issues, the public are better informed. At the moment, you know, there are public representations on health boards of PCTs and so on, but you know, you'd be hard, even less people would know who they are than know who councillors are, and yet we're relatively easy to find on websites and so on, and the process is transparent. So I mean, let's move it much more, let's move this scrutiny of these decisions much more into a group of people who at least can be removed or elected by people.
With an aging population, can we afford health service reorganization and cuts?
The danger. I mean, what we've seen with the reform of the universities, with the tuition fees, is it transpires that all of the universities are actually going to charge the top rate of £9,000, which of course they would, because they've got an oversupply. There's more demand for places than supply. So in actual fact, the policy that's being pursued, if it isn't changed, will probably end up being more expensive than the existing setup of providing teaching support and the students paying lower fees. Now, what worries me about a lot of what the coalition is proposing is that in actual fact, they're presented as kind of cost-saving measures, when in actual fact, they're more expensive, and any change is expensive in itself. Yeah,
I mean, I'm always wary of government with big solution, whoever it happens
to be. If it was that easy, why wasn't it done before?
Well, exactly. I mean, we saw that with the private finance initiative, which was a great panacea, because it kept... You could build hospitals and you could build schools, and it wasn't on the books in terms of public sector borrowing. And yet we know that, like leasing a car rather than buying one, over 25 years, it's going to cost you more. And yet we were in, you know, huge denial of ministers saying, oh, no, don't, that's not the case. And yet you knew that that was the issue. So we've got to make sure that doesn't happen, and that we have a cost-effective service, but equally one that provides the care that we need.
This week we will talk about pension age. Steve, pension reform, can you discuss this?
Big topic, isn't it? I mean, the demographics are people are living longer, and that's... You see that everywhere, and pressure on pension ages. I think when Bismarck brought 65 in, I think the expectation was that people would live 5 to 7 years after that, and, you know, it's now... increasingly more than that. I think we've got to get away from the concept of people are working full pelt and then there's a cliff edge and then they're retiring and not working at all. I think we need flexibility. The difficulty is, if someone's a, you know, car mechanic or a roofer, you know, it's probably not the sort of occupation that they can carry on in at 70. But if someone's a an accountant or a lawyer, then they may well be able to work a couple of days a week, or maybe not on such complex cases or whatever. So, I mean, I think we need a more flexible concept of what work and retirement is.
Is it popular for staff at Bristol City Council to want to work beyond 65?
Well, I mean, if you're being told you're going to have to work longer than you thought you were when you took it up, then clearly that's not going to be something that is universally popular. What we have done on the council is made use of things, because obviously we're, like the rest of the economy, abolishing a maximum retirement age, so you won't be able to force people to leave at 65. But what you are seeing now is people with contributions, long contributions in, doing what they call a step down, where they go to part-time and draw their pension if they're entitled to it and so on. And I see this as being a sort of flexibility that we need, maybe dropping down into a lower-graded post. So, yeah, I don't think anyone's ecstatic about the change, but, I mean, the Hutton Review makes it very clear that the case for having a different retirement age in a pension scheme to the retirement age for the state pension, it is difficult to argue. And I think certainly on the Local Government Association, all parties see the logic of bringing those two together. But it will take time. You can bring it in now for new entrants, but you have to offer some sort of transitional protection to people already in the system.
Martin, the proportion of the population age over 65 is currently around 18.5%, and the number is expected to increase by 60% over the next 25 years. Youth unemployment for 16-24 years old is currently more than 1 in 5. Is it good for the economy and society to encourage people to work longer?
Well, we need to have some kind of... If we need to actually think about work as a whole, in a holistic way, over a whole lifetime. I think it's quite interesting what Steve was saying about being a roofer or a road mender.
Yeah.
I think those people should be entitled to retire at 65, if you're out there in all weathers doing a physical job. And that's part of having a fairer society, not social mobility. Some people get to do the accountant's jobs, and they might want to work over after 65. But it should be, if you're doing a tough... dirty manual job, you should have they tend to die younger. Yeah. We all know this. And therefore, they will only get the same amount of retirement as a wealthy person. And actually trying to create the quality of life for everybody is tremendously important. I mean, you saw all the riots and strikes in France over the attempt to raise the pension age. And that was not really because people, the interview people say, well, we accept the raising of the pension age, actually, but we just don't accept it in this format. Mm. And we think that the whole attitude of the government towards us is wrong. And I saw one of the posters, one of the protesters was holding up saying, grandma and grandpa at work, youth on the dole, no thanks. And that is effectively where we're going, is that people are going to be forced to work while we've got 25% youth unemployment. I mean, this is just crazy. We're going to have to do something about this, but the market isn't going to do it on its own.
Thank you. Now, next news. Alternative vote referendum. Martin, there is a public debate tomorrow in Bristol about the AV system. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, it's part of the Bristol Speaker's Corner project, which is an attempt to kind of get more people talking about politics on the streets. I actually applied to be the coordinator for this, but I didn't get interviewed. It's the idea is, I mean, is to get street... I mean, they used to be in the 60s, I believe... People used to go up onto the Downs on a Sunday to do sort of speaker's corner type things. And gradually the tradition in Bristol died out. But I think the idea of this is to revive this on College Green. So it'll be from midday tomorrow, I believe. Yes, noon. There's going to be a debate about the referendum, the AV referendum. And I'd encourage... listeners to go along and see what people have got to say. And of course, if you want to say something yourself, the platform will be open to people to come up and say what they want to say. Incidentally, I've spoken at Speaker's Corner, and one of the problems you have there is what I would call hostile heckling. And the way I've had to deal with it when I've been speaking there is you try and draw these people into a discussion. We're not having a shouting match. You will get your go, and I will get my go. And that's the only way to run it, in my view.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good initiative, this Speaker's Corner. I hope it catches on. But one of the things that has disappointed me since I came back as a councillor, I was a councillor in the 1980s, and I re-elected in 2005, is increasingly you see quite shrill debates, and people think that, you know, the way to win an argument is to just shout everyone else down.
Or abuse your opponent.
Or abuse your opponent, or shout louder. And I don't mean in party political sense, I mean in terms of some of the issues. I know feelings run high, but, you know, I've said to people that actually, you know, shouting at me is not normally a very effective way of influencing how I might vote on something. So I welcome this. I think it's good. The more publicity we can get for the referendum on alternative vote, the better.
Okay, moving on to Mau Mau. The Mau Mau from Kenya are in the High Court in London, claiming abuses by the British. What is this all about, Martin? Can you start?
Well, Tony and myself did an interview with an ex-service person who'd served in Kenya as a result of, in the 1950s. I mean, these people are not necessarily Mau Mau. What they were detainees in the British... Gulag system, which is what it was. And at the time in Kenya, there's research, new research now from Oxford and Harvard University has shown that in Kenya, in the 1950s, there were as many people imprisoned for political reasons as in the Soviet Union. And they were being given very hard treatment indeed, including electrocutions, castrations, and executions. It was a very, very dark... It's a very dark shadow over Britain's record, and this stuff has come out now because of the documentation at the time, which was claimed to have been lost, has been found, and all the documentation about what went on in the prison system. There's a very good book about it, which unfortunately I have not got a reference to at the moment. It's written by a Harvard historian from Harvard. All of the documentation was removed to Britain so that there would be no evidence for any kind of prosecutions. And the British government are still maintaining in the High Court that all abuses must be referred to the Kenyan government, the post-independence government, and they won't take any responsibility for what they did. The deal done between Kenyatta and the British at the end of all of this was that Kenyatta, who was actually held in prison but he wasn't actually one of the fighters, he was actually held in a rather nice prison with better facilities. He was allowed to take over, provided that nobody on the British side was ever prosecuted or held to account. It's pretty much like the changes in Eastern Europe, Marina. Yeah, the Communist Party agreed to give up power as long as nobody is going to be punished for past behaviours, and the British did a similar deal with the Kenyans. But of course, the world turns and things move on. They've got a similar problem now in Spain, where many people whose families were killed by Franco are saying, well, we agreed at the time that we weren't going to look back at this, but in actual fact, we do want to look back at it now, because we're a different generation. I think this is Britain's Spanish Civil War, and many people out there will not be aware of the very, very bad behaviour of the British in this particular case. It's been compared to the Gulag and other atrocities of a similar kind.
I mean, it does partly explain that, when you read about the Mau Mau Rebellion, you know, just how bloodthirsty the whole thing was. And, it sounds to me like what you had was an escalation. So the more mistreatment you had of prisoners, then the more, you know, throat-cutting and real unpleasantness and attacks on villages you had from the other side. And clearly there was this escalation. Now, probably at the time, if you talk to my father's generation, then they only were only given one side of that story. There is always going to be this difficulty about what you do in post-conflict situation. And I saw an interesting film a few weeks ago about Cyprus, where they've got a committee on missing persons, right? People who went missing either in the 63 intercommunal violence or in the Turkish invasion of 1974. And, you know, they are actually exhuming bodies and, you know, getting closure. And it's a bi-communal project. Something similar, I think, was part of the solution to the Northern Ireland problem. And, you know, I never thought someone like Peter Robinson would go to a Catholic Requiem Mass, for instance, but he did this week. The one place where it seems to be the model for this is probably South Africa, with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that did actually say, look, we've got to put this behind us and move on, but we can't just pretend it didn't happen. And I think the danger with the post-colonial issue with the British and the independent rulers is there was an attempt to try and bury the past, and it tends to come back and haunt.
I think many of the people in Kenya, I remember reading the book, and one of the women said they were asked about what they felt about the collaborators, who they're still living cheek by jowl with the people who were collaborators and who often got the land of the people who were imprisoned. And they're saying, we are Christians, we forgive them. And then when you press them and say, well, actually, we don't, we hate them tremendously. But what would really help us to get over this is some recognition of our suffering, because there's not one single memorial to the Mau Mau dead in Kenya. That was one of the deals, is that the new regime would just bury the whole thing.
Well, I think that's. I think things have moved on. I mean, you know, the slaughter of following the Bangladesh War in 71 too. I mean, there's been no recognition of the genocide that was done over that. Now, nowadays, we have the International Criminal Court, and we can bring people to task. But we didn't have that then, and indeed, again, that's another bitter conflict where there's been no real recognition of that. And I think, you know, that does need to happen before you can move on.
For a British audience, I think we also need to recognise Britain's role in this, because we tend to think of ourselves as the good guys, you know, invading Libya to rescue people, etc., etc. But in actual fact, in Kenya, Britain is known as a brutal, brutal coloniser. We're talking, they were talking originally that 11,000 people were tortured to death. The Harvard, the Oxford study suggests more like 250,000 tortured to death. That's a big number.
I think it was. I think it was the whole colonial ethos. Though. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the Belgian Congo was a pretty bloody mess, as was some of the, you know, French Indochina, Dutch East Indies, and so on. I mean, it went throughout. It was the, but I think the mentality of colonialism is something that those of us who've grown up in the post-independent age find it hard to connect with. And yet, when you read contemporary accounts in the newspaper, it was just assumed that.
There was a racist idea about the whole term Mau Mau was invented by the British to kind of demonise their enemies, yeah. You know, they're evil witch doctor type people. In actual fact, they called themselves the Land and Freedom Army. That's what they thought of. Right. That's what they thought they were.
Yeah.
And of course, they you know, I mean, these kind of guerrilla wars are pretty horrible, like in Chechnya. You know, there's the atrocities on all sides are very likely to occur.
Let's move on to the 50th anniversary of first space flight and the start of the new era. Half a century ago, on the 12th of April 1961, the space age began when Russian astronaut Yuri Gagarin circumnavigated the Earth in flight of 108 minutes through space in the spaceship Vostok 1. Every year on April 12 is celebrated in Russia as a day of astronautics, and 2011 has officially declared the year of Russian space exploration. When I was lucky enough to interview Russian astronaut Viktor Afanasyev, who went into space 4 times and spent 555 days and 18 hours and 33 minutes and 54 seconds in space, he attributed his achievement to taking every opportunity from life and expanding new horizons. Also, he emphasized that one of the main things necessary for selection to fly is being in perfect health. This goes down to the finest details, such as your fingers' nails. Now the situation has significantly changed, with the company Virgin proposing to offer 5-minute space flights for the £125,000 or $200,000. The company has around 400 confirmed bookings. Steve, is this a sensible way to spend money?
No, I don't think it is at all. I mean, if you're super rich, then you can do all sorts of things, but I do worry about the environmental impact of this sort of thing. It's not, you know, burning up all those gases for 5 minutes of pleasure. It doesn't sit well with me.
Well, I think we need to have some space in exploration. I mean, if we find new things out by going into space, don't we? But I mean, at the time when we're facing depression and war, maybe that's not so.
You are listening.
Thank you, thank you. Well, we are coming up to Sky News at 6 o'clock. Thank you to this week's guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Eastville, Steve Hombe, and Martin Summers.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.